Andrew.
And I'm Spencer, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today, we'll be speaking with Hari Kunzru, the author of novels including The Impressionist, White Tears, and most recently, Red Pill.
Hari is also the host of the new podcast, Into the Zone. He's an honorary fellow of Oxford. He has received fellowships from the New York Public Library, the Guggenheim Foundation, and the American Academy in Berlin.
As both a leading writer and thinker, Hari is really the kind of artist we need to be hearing from more today. Hari has a rare ability to draw on allegories that reflect our current condition to enable us to imagine a different, even hopeful future. Let's get him on the line. Hi, Hari. Welcome to At a Distance. It's so great to have you with us today.
Well, it's very nice to be here.
So, to start, what is at the top of your mind right now?
Oh, wow. Survival through to like January sometime. I don't know about you, but my time horizon throughout this whole pandemic has become very limited. The only way I've found I can really handle it is just kind of setting quite limited goals and, advancing forward little by little, because it's just impossible to predict. Mm. You know, we've got no sense politically or in any other way what kind of context we're going to be in.
How do you think in general we should be thinking about this moment?
Well, I was worried early, I suppose I could say that. I mean, I look back at things that I was writing in, you know, nonfiction things I was writing in 2015, and I was extremely concerned about what was, you know, coming down the pike then. Mm. And I think that we need to think of this as a sort of black swan event. You know, I think there was a great deal of, if not complacency, then certainly belief that a lot of institutions and a lot of social norms were stronger than they've turned out to be. Mm-hmm. And we're in a situation where I think almost anything is possible. And it's very easy to just disbelieve that because it kind of goes against all our instincts. You know, you want it to be fine. We always, always want it to basically be fine. And for it not to be fine, you know, opens us up into some very sort of terrifying spaces. But I think we have at least to be gaming out some quite dark situations at the moment.
And you recently published a new novel, Red Pill. What's it been like for you to put a book out in the midst of this?
It's been muted. I would say that would be a good word for it. You know, I mean, normally you put a book out and then suddenly you're in front of audiences and you have a kind of sense of how it's functioning in the world. And you have that now too, but it's all very abstract. Like I did an event last night, mm-hmm. a live reading and conversation, and you know, you say good night and they switch off the Zoom link and you're just there in your in your room, and you're like, there's no kind of, you know, chatting with the audience afterwards, going for a drink, all the ways that you kind of wind down from that social moment back into privacy. So, you know, it's odd, but I mean, I am somebody who had quite a, you know, an active online life anyway. And in some ways, I think this has all disrupted my routine less than it might have disrupted some other people.
Yeah. And Red Pill, of course, is like sort of an extension or exploration of sorts, at least, of this post-Trump paranoia that we're all kind of feeling and grappling with. I'm wondering, are you thinking about what you wrote in that book any differently now that we're in this global pandemic and that certain things that underlie the narrator's sort of thoughts or the narrative anyway have kind of bubbled to life? And I mean, there's sort of a real Black Mirror quality to what we're going through and also what you express in the book.
I mean, I started writing the book, you know, before the last election, and at a time when, you know, I suppose I spend too much time on the far right internet, lurking on the far right internet, and I, for a number of years, I've looked at what's happening on the chans, and I've tried to kind of work out the kind of cultural changes that are happening on the right, why there's a sort of younger, very energized, very kind of culturally confident far right, which wasn't the case a decade ago. And I had that sense of like, I'm seeing something coming towards me, but in the mainstream culture, you know, people were just carrying on as if it was all normal, mm-hmm. as if this didn't exist. And then, of course, it sort of erupted during the election campaign 2015, 2016, and people suddenly were seeing, what is this cartoon frog I am seeing around? And then I think, of course, Charlottesville, the visibility of and the kind of weird cultural signifiers that were everywhere at Charlottesville, the kind of the sigils on the shields, all that kind of stuff, was suddenly a lot of people realized that there was a very developed culture that hadn't been visible to them before. And as you know, a novel is a very slow thing. It's a year since I finished work on it, and writing it was several years before that. So you have no sense of how the thing you've made is going to converge with reality. Mm-hmm. And I wanted it to kind of drop now before the election. I mean, a lot of people are trying to push their fiction back until the new year because, I mean, everybody is preoccupied. But I felt this is a book that could speak to this present moment. Mm. But I couldn't have predicted the level of weirdness with the pandemic as well. And that, you know, and I've spoken just now about this isolation that we're all experiencing. Here's, you know, I can see everybody on the screen, you know, in our funny little spaces, conducting our professional lives in these weird little kind of homemade bubbles that we have. And I think that exacerbates this strange feeling of panic and unreality at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, over the summer when the protests were going very strong here in New York, I got the sense that there was something very visceral about the release for people of just being with other people. And the ones I attended, I mean, I didn't do a lot of protesting because I'm not a citizen. And, you know, if I got picked up, it could be the end of my life in America. But, you know, I did a little bit of marching, and it was very, very kind of powerful to be in a crowd. You know, we're trying to find ways of being together collectively when we can't, you know, when it's very physically difficult to be together. And I think that's almost unprecedented. That's a strangeness that is going to have very deep effects in the culture.
Mm. Connected to this sense of isolationism that you're talking about, you know, you were early on 4chan and you've written about things you've seen there and were aware of this building community that's expressing itself very loudly now. Do you think that this isolationism is actually creating more opportunity for that to exist because people are spending even more time in those spaces in hyper-normalizing in these echo chambers?
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, we were worried about silos anyway before this started, and we're now quite aware that there's this kind of Facebook uncle silo where the information sources are deranged and untrustworthy, but very kind of strongly believed. But we're finding, I mean, the idea of public space, I mean, it's one of the things I came back to in the book. You know, the novel's got this sort of rather grumpy writer character goes on a fellowship to a German institution that's been set up by an industrialist, you know, using his money. And he's a believer in the public and in this sort of Habermasian idea of a sort of discursive space where everybody's going to get together and rationally discuss. And out of that is going to come some sort of, you know, the best way of doing things. And that's very, very hard to hold on to right now. Mm. You know, I mean, our discursive spaces are noisy and freaked out, and, you know, are these kind of micro spaces that don't necessarily connect to everybody else's spaces. So the idea that we can all come together in some sort of quasi Greek agora kind of space is really, like, it feels like something that is receding into the distance. It was a sort of liberal post-war dream, you know, it was the sort of social democratic dream, and it was very important in Germany in the sort of post-Nazi period. But it is something, as you say, that we're finding it very, very hard to find these realities that are commensurate with other people's realities.
Mm. One thing I've really been wanting to ask you about is QAnon. You know, I was in upstate New York last week, and I'm at the grocery store, and I see a huge QAnon sticker on a car, and I go into the grocery store, I do my shopping. The guy in the aisle next to me I didn't realize at the time it was his car, but he's wearing a MAGA hat and no face mask, the only one in the store, and the face mask pulled down, and a t-shirt that says, Trump 2020, fuck your feelings. And he had a huge QAnon sticker on his car, so there was this weird sort of two sides of it. And I think a lot of people don't understand what's relevant about those two things. One, the fuck your feelings, and the other one is the QAnon being normalized. So I'd love to hear from you about those two ideas.
I mean, I'm so glad you brought up the fuck your feelings meme or whatever it is, because that's been very interesting to me for a while, because it is a reaction to a particular strand of, I suppose you'd call it, liberal identity politics, which has very much valorized personal experience. You know, the kind of statements which are prefaced with, as a race position, class position, gender position person, you know,
yeah,
my utterance now has to be taken seriously. So this kind of rejection of that is a very strong part of the right's kind of ideology at the moment. And it connects with the kind of people you find online who have the Greek philosopher Avis, who are all about, well, this, I'm about objective rationality, and you're so mixed up in your social justice warrior feelings that you're unable to discuss things rationally. Of course, when you look at the people who are asserting themselves, saying, you know, your feelings don't count, only, you know, objectivity counts, these people are absolutely prisoners of their emotions at the same time. And QAnon is an extraordinary phenomenon. I don't know, did you see this week there were massive QAnon protests in London and Berlin?
Yeah.
And QAnon has become a kind of a thing for the far right in Germany as well, because it apparently hooks into a lot of pre-existing conspiracy theory stuff in Germany. And I mean, Britain's always had a kind of quite a lot of, you know, ideological traffic between the UK and the US. But I mean, the QAnon thing is completely fascinating for kind of a number of reasons. But I mean, it's, you know, firstly, we've had several generations of understanding of what people call the paranoid style in American politics. You know, I mean, that Hofstadter article from the 1960s that people kind of hone in on as identifying this strand in American public life, which is to do with conspiracy. It is to do with a very kind of overheated notion of the danger that is coming. You know, back in the day, that was Reds under the bed, and now it's child molesting cannibals under a pizza place. But I mean, the thing to say about all conspiracy is that it's a kind of reductive thing, and it's comforting because it's reductive. Think about the idea of plot. Plot is a sort of structure that you impose on reality. You know, every novelist understands that you simplify things and you clarify things to make a plot. And a conspiracy works in the same thing. You know, you have a kind of very inchoate, complicated situation. You know, you've lost your job, things seem to be going badly, the neighborhood isn't like it used to be. And it's very hard to kind of grasp all the complex social forces that might have brought that about. But if you say, well, there's a bunch of guys in secret who are doing this to you, and it's to their advantage to do you, that is a clear explanation. It's a very comforting explanation, because it holds out the possibility that you could find those guys and you could stop them. And QAnon's promise is a very ancient promise, and it's the promise that underneath the sort of dust and confusion of the world, there's something simple and there's somebody who knows the truth, and you will help that person find the truth. Where we go one, we go all. All together, we will come together in the name of the truth. We'll overturn the evil, the demiurge that's in charge of things, and we'll get back to the garden. I mean, it's Manichaeism. It's like, you know, God created the earth, God created the world, but the world has somehow been taken over by an evil God, and that we, the kind of the knowers, the truth seekers, are gonna be the ones to overturn that regime and bring us back to Eden. And so I understand on that level, especially now, I mean, the pandemic is an invisible thing. Of all the kind of types of paranoia we could possibly be experienced, the idea of virus, something too small to see. You may be in contact with an asymptomatic individual who seems completely normal, but they may be infected. And What if somebody does say to you, well, you've been told that by the power structure, you've been told to be afraid of your neighbors, you've been told to wear a mask like some sort of strange fetishist, but actually everything's fine and they're just trying to separate you out and you come together and you'll be fine. I mean, that is a hugely powerful message. I mean, I think if you kind of remind people of the facts of the case that, you know, that piece of place didn't have a basement, they feel that that's going to be sufficient to wean people off this story. But the story is a very powerful emotional story and is a way of people rationalizing complexity and is a way of people dealing with their fear. So, I mean, it's very frightening because it means that you can't deal with it on the level of facts. You can't clarify things because it just speaks on this very, very profound emotional level.
And there's a second order of it in the way that Trump is using that same rhetoric as a sort of gaslighting technique right now. And what's interesting is, you know, no one stops to think about the fact that, you know, the closest thing to the conspiracies were things that Jeffrey Epstein was involved in, you know, things that Barr's father was involved in. These are like very, very odd connectivity points. So I was wondering if you have a clarity on or some sort of way to articulate the way that the gaslighting is actually working and how it's connected to QAnon.
I mean, the idea of projection is so weirdly interesting whenever you deal with Trump and the Trump circle. Virtually everything they accuse their enemies of doing turns out to be something they're actually doing. Mm-hmm. Trump is almost compelled to tell the truth. I mean, he's this very strange creature in that way, in that he's the man with a lot to lose by telling the truth. But somehow it always in some form comes out of his mouth. And I think that's the world they live in, that inner circle live in a deeply corrupt and deeply vicious world. And so that's the reality. And they know that that world is at odds with the, you know, the professed set of beliefs, all this kind of, you know, God and country business that they sell. So the accusation of especially sort of sexual corruption, it comes very easily to them because that's what they understand. And I don't think Trump is a smart person, but he has this kind of instinct for chaos. We're in a moment where we understand something about disinformation that maybe we didn't understand before. And it's that you don't need to sell a lie to people. You don't need to have a coherent alternative story that is more convincing. It's just in Bannon's phrase, you flood the zone with shit. Like you have so many refracted versions of things that is really impossible for anybody who's not going to devote their whole time to it to untangle that. So people do just sort of default to whatever explanation is congenial to them. And, you know, for every fact, there's an alternative fact. I mean, it's something that I suppose we could, to some extent, sort of, you know, thank the FSB because, I mean, it is a Russian. It's a very developed Russian news management technique. And I don't know the history of this stuff enough to say whether we could really say it's them. I'm sure the CIA have done their share of this in the past. But you don't need to have a good lie. You just need to provide so many alternatives that it exceeds people's capacity to understand.
Mm. In your book, there seems to be this fine line between the logical and the illogical, which seems to connect interestingly to what we're talking about here. In your mind, other than the forces we've been discussing, what's making us feel so mixed up right now? Like, what do you think's really kind of creating this line between the logical and the illogical?
I mean, it's something to do with desire, and it's something to do with realities that are drawing us towards them. Mm. You know, years ago, I was part of a kind of scene in the UK around a sort of bunch of theory people and art school people. And one of the terms that came out of that was hyperstition, which is this notion that there are certain ideas which kind of act as attractors and sort of pull you towards them. And they sort of clothe themselves in flesh. So there's a sort of speculation that has this kind of power. And I think that sort of feels intuitively quite strange to talk about possible futures drawing you towards them. But I think there's something there. It seems that at the moment, whatever your most chaotic imagination produces turns out to be true 6 weeks later. I mean, with the sort of standard, you can just have hashtag 2020 anything with kind of the most ridiculous thing, like we've got a forest fire on top of a pandemic. And, I saw a picture the other day of somewhere in California where there was a sign reminding people to wear their masks, and the landscape around it is just burning.
Yeah.
And you're like, I wouldn't have imagined that. But yeah, that's absolutely the reality we live in now. And that's a bit scary because you imagine something and in that kind of almost magical way, you wonder whether by imagining it, you're in some way bringing it true. I mean, that's headed deeply into the tinfoil hat kind of causality. But there's a quality of that in our world at the moment that makes everything feel very thin and very, very insubstantial. And the idea that the transition from, your stoned imagination to having to live it the next day is a thing that could happen.
Mm. Surveillance is another theme in your novel or sort of thread that is appearing throughout, often talking about this idea of like transparency and how do you view surveillance in the world right now? And was your novel a way of sort of expressing your feelings on that front?
Well, surveillance and privacy were the sort of starting points for the book. I mean, I wanted to think about what it means that our privacy has been so thoroughly hollowed out to the extent that we don't really have a profound expectation of privacy anymore. Certainly for much of our lives, we know that we are at least potentially being watched or recorded. And I'm interested in how that changes our behavior and how that leads us to sense certain things and how that reduces the scope or the space in which we imagine, in which we have our dangerous imaginings, our kind of, our genuinely private imaginings. What does that mean for us as people? I mean, there's Hannah Arendt talks about going forth into the world, in order to be a kind of ethical subject, you have to have a choice to go into public. You have to be able to sort of step forward into the light out of your private space and say, this is what I think and, this is what I have. But often what happens now is that all our kind of, scribblings, our workings out are happening in public and we seem much more kind of disordered and messy as a result of that. I mean, I've been thinking about this for a long time. I mean, the sort of only really proper job I had in my life in some ways was as an editor on Wired magazine in the 1990s. Wired set up a British edition and I got hired onto that as basically about the only person who had an internet connection at that point. And it was like, but I ended up, I mean, it was such a weird day. I'd been trying to get an interview with the Conservative minister who was in charge of surveillance. And he was giving grants to put cameras into small communities in Britain where they'd never kind of considered having a surveillance camera before. And I was very concerned about this. And I mean, people were saying, well, what's the problem? If you have nothing to hide, why would you worry about being watched? And that, I mean, and I am a sort of more than mildly paranoid person anyway. And I mean, it just sat really badly with me. And I've been trying to get this interview for a while. And then I got a call saying, he's got half an hour for you like this afternoon, like you've got to get over there right away. And I was not dressed for a kind of, proper political interview. I was dressed in what you'd wear in a kind of tech office. And I had this t-shirt saying, fuck Britpop. And I mean, I basically had to kind of switch this t-shirt around and wear it inside out. And I turned up looking, they just couldn't believe it. Like the young special advisors, these kind of well-turned out Tory boys in their suits and ties just basically would, I mean, I couldn't even get into the building at first because they thought I was a courier who'd come to, I was a bike messenger. anyway, I get into the room with this guy finally, and he can't quite believe this scruffy little 26-year-old has turned up. And I say to him, why are you putting in place this infrastructure of surveillance? Isn't this a hostage to fortune? Isn't this, how can you guarantee this imagery won't be misused? What about privacy? And he just said to me, people want it. People desire this. They feel safer if they see a camera in the village square. And essentially, I realized at that point that we were lost. There was no real kind of emotional wish to protect a certain sort of visual privacy. I mean, in general, in Britain, it's very hard to get people to rally around issues of civil liberties anyway, because there's not that First Amendment tradition in the UK. I mean, people are fucking useless about it, to be quite honest. Like they have a very, I mean, maybe less now, but certainly they have a sense that, well, the government's broadly here to help and they wouldn't overstep things. And
they like to queue.
Yeah, I mean, at least the good part of the kind of queue, gun-toting, Michigan militia, Trump world, is that there is a sense that you have a space that you need to protect against the state. And, you know, obviously that takes everybody off into some pretty wild and illogical places. But and that sort of visual surveillance, I've been thinking about that for a long time. And I had a friend who actually managed to make a film shot entirely on surveillance cameras. Like, she would act out scenes in front of surveillance cameras and then do freedom of information requests to get the footage.
Amazing.
And she managed over a course of several years to put together a short film, a narrative film.
Brilliant.
Which is an amazing, amazing thing to do. But, you know, I mean, it would break my head to try and do that.
Painstaking.
But we're into a much more kind of profound level of that. I mean, I think people didn't understand the power of predictive analytics, and people didn't understand the power of the aggregation of information until quite recently.
Do you think when people text on their phone, like you texting a buddy, do you think people think that is not between them and the person they're texting?
I think they know, maybe if they're informed, they know rationally that, you know, that's going into some sort of large corpus that will be used for all sorts of, you know, to make better predictive text. But I want to text my friend, you know, and I say that thing anyway. I send the sext. I do whatever it is that is nominally private. And because I can't visualize the person who's eavesdropping, it's very easy to imagine that person doesn't exist. I mean, I'm very conservative with my electronic communications anyway. You know, there are things that I don't talk about. I mean, also post 9/11 is another story as well. I mean, I've grown up looking like the guy most likely to hijack your plane, which means that certainly in the years after 9/11, I had a particular kind of experience in airports, and I had to be very guarded about certain sorts of conversation. I remember I was going somewhere, there was an extra line of security, and this person says to me, "What's the purpose of your visit?" And I said, "Tourism." But I, with my accent, it sounded like terrorism. Yeah, off to the little room I went, and you know, and I mean, it was I fucked it up, and those kind of things. I mean, another funny story is the time that I got on the plane and I started reading my book, and I had forgotten that I was actually reading a Penguin translation of the Quran, and the entire rest of the row had a kind of opinion about my reading. So there was the nice liberal lady who was trying to make a lot of eye contact with me to say, like, "I really respect your religion and it's the religion of peace." And I was like, "No, I'm just reading this because I never read this book." And, you know, and there's the guy who's trying to kind of work out whether he could take me in a fight. So that kind of, you know, post 9/11 security culture has completely changed things. I mean, you guys are, seem like you're younger than me, but there was a time where you used to be able to kind of wander around and be very loose in international travel situations, and that has completely vanished.
Yeah, there's something I want to bring up here about nuance in conversation. And, you know, in culture and society these days, there's this urge, and this connects to your podcast, which we'll get to see everything in black and white. I was wondering what your thoughts are on this, in the context of all the conversations we've already been having on this episode, but also just the notion of cancel culture, these things that are kind of happening where people just, they think one way is the right way, and there's a lack of conversation and nuance.
Well, I mean, I wonder whether you could make the case that cancel culture comes from the same sort of deep desire for simplicity that conspiracy culture comes from. I mean, it would be very nice to be able to point to the 12 racists in charge and get rid of them, and then everybody else would be happy in the valley together. But the fact is that if you take this seriously, you have to understand that we're enmeshed in all these complicated structural positions where even if we try on a personal level to be, say, anti-racist, very often we find ourselves in positions where we're reinforcing power structures and so on. So, I mean, I blame sort of Protestantism for a certain amount of it. I think there's an American political tradition that comes out of the Massachusetts colony and you know, they were people who took a long sea voyage rather than compromise their beliefs about purity. Mm. And there's something very deep in the American political scene that kind of maps onto that idea of we are the pure ones and the ones that are against us are the, we have to overthrow them in order to build the shining city on the hill, you know, the city of God. And I'm instinctively suspicious of appeals to purity because they're abstractions and they, you know, these are complicated political questions that don't map very easily onto ideas about morality. Having said that, I think it is a good thing in the culture that we are working out what the limits of a certain sort of supposed neutrality or objectivity are. Like, for example, I mean, the convention in journalism is that you speak from this rather sort of disinterested place and mm-hmm. that you yourself are not putting your thumb on the scales of the thing you're describing. And you would, for example, talk about both sides of the question, whatever that question would be. To circle back to the information and politics in the Trump era, what happens when one side of the question is Q? This kind of came up years ago with evolution and creationism, the way that the Christian right found to kind of wedge creationism into the public conversation was to demand that people teach the controversy to give equal weight to these both sides. So we're now getting better at sort of saying, look, I have a position. Here I am. You can see who I am. You know, you can draw certain conclusions about my class position, my financial position, my racial background, whatever it would be. I'm going to make this case. You can add your bit of skepticism into my case because, you know, I'm being upfront about who I am making it. Mm-hmm. That seems to me a more sophisticated position than the position which says I am magically capable of neutrality and I'm magically capable of stepping outside my obvious interests and positions.
So I want to bring up the podcast you just launched here, Into the Zone, which is about opposites. So life and death, native and migrant, public, private. What have you learned about borders and the sort of dissonance between seeing things in black and white?
It is part of this sort of larger project I have to talk about the kind of ethics that comes out of trying to occupy ambiguous places. Mm-hmm. The traditional idea would be, you know, you're an ethical person if you have a clear moral position, and if things get gray and fuzzy, then you're in trouble. But there's an ethics that come out of being able to understand your own ambiguities and your own complexities. Mm. And so, you know, the podcast is a way of telling a lot of different kinds of stories. Many of them are stories that I came across while writing fiction, and just it was sort of better as real stories than as fictional narratives. And trying to speak personally has been very interesting. I mean, I'm somebody who hides behind characters in novels a lot. And, you know, talking about what it was like, for example, to grow up in Essex in the kind mm-hmm. of suburbs of London and, you know, how I negotiated my racial identity there. That's been a very interesting thing to try and speak about that. And to be honest, also, I mean, as you know, as podcasters, you know, what works in a podcast is quite a personal, direct tone. Mm-hmm. It's a very intimate thing. You know, people are listening on their headphones. You're in their head. They want to get a sense of you as a human. Mm. And writing that rather than, you know, trying to make some sort of grand argument, you have to be engaging and to be able to kind of find a, if not simple, just as a straightforward route through complicated topics has been a really interesting challenge as a writer.
Yeah, for your ears only. It's a different kind of thing.
Mm.
In regards to the Black Lives Matter movement and the summer protests, why do you think it took a global pandemic for this conversation to reignite the way it has?
I mean, I think there's some very practical explanations for that. I mean, a lot of people lost their jobs. A lot of people can't work. People are at home. They're staring very difficult financial circumstances in the face. People are kind of looking around and seeing that the system as it is not working for them. And so that, I think, has radicalized a lot of people. And the fact that the George Floyd murder took place right in the middle of that and provided such an unambiguous visual of the system at work. You know, there was something about the bland way that policeman carried on killing that man in front of cameras, and in fact, he had no sense that he was going to be called to account at all.
Mm-hmm. Hand in the pocket.
Yeah. And that was so irrefutable. But I do think in practical terms, you know, people are able to organize because they don't have other things that they can do, that they, you know, they need to do.
What's giving you the most hope right now?
I have had a great sense of hope from watching people younger than me, people in their 20s and 30s, who have, I think, very little to lose, actually, who are very clear about the stakes of the current moment and who haven't got kind of mixed up in protecting their little piece of the pie because the boomers ate all the pie. I think there's a chance for some radical reconfiguration of things because there is a huge political will and people are not being well served by things how they are. I mean, of course, there's a danger in that as well, and that one of the forces that is trying to take advantage of that dissatisfaction is a force of the extreme right. But in ancient Greek terms, this is kairos. This is a time of chance. This is a time when you can seize a new reality and make it into flesh.
Mm. Hari, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for coming on today.
Well, thanks for this great conversation. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter exploring the five senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.